Chairman and my friends, it was with some satisfaction that I heard Mr. Denny say just before the air became available to us that he was certain that all the people in this audience understood the rules and regulations under which this discussion was conducted. And it was satisfactory and reassuring to me because Mr. Sikorski and I don't understand the rules, and Mr. Denny has just been telling us out back what they were, and final whispered instructions have been given to us. So that if I break the rules, I shall have to ask to be forgiven under the plea that I have not had enough instruction from Mr. Denny. However, I am delighted to be here tonight and to have this opportunity of discussing with you the question, should we plan for Social Security? And certainly that question deserves the thought and consideration of all intelligent people in the United States. As the chairman of President Roosevelt's Committee on Economic Security, upon which the report of the present Social Security Act is based, and from my own experience of some 15 odd years in studying this question in its various phases, my answer to the question will be unreservedly in the affirmative. We've got, of course, to define what we mean by security, I suppose, and the dictionaries seem to lean heavily to the conception that security means reasonable freedom from fear and anxiety, with confidence of safety, some of them throw in, and one dictionary adds, assurance. The security, therefore, of the men, women, and children of this nation, when we consider it in terms of its economic and social aspects, is, it seems to me, like liberty, one of the chief objectives of our association as a nation. And it is embraced within those famous words of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For life and the pursuit of happiness in modern America certainly include the conception of economic security. Without that, the other words become mere forms and abstractions. And to attain these objectives under modern ideas of what these ancient abstractions really mean in modern society requires forethought by individuals, forethought by society itself, together with organization and systematic performance along the lines of an agreed-upon plan. Organized foresight, in other words, is necessary both for society and for individuals, and for both in common, to overcome the modern hazards, the modern economic hazards, as they afflict the individual in modern society, requires forethought by individuals, forethought by society itself, together with organization and systematic performance along the lines of an agreed-upon plan. Organized foresight, in other words, is necessary both for society and for individuals, and for both in common, to overcome the modern hazards, the modern economic hazards, as they afflict the individual. The modern conception of the possibilities and needs for a good life is, of course, much larger today than it used to be. And today's necessity for group or community planning is obvious and striking because, well, transportation, communication, the radio itself, machinery have served to reduce time and space as factors of life and have made cooperation essential to the production and distribution of the goods and services which we all need and all use. This element of cooperation and mutuality has become so basic in our daily life as we go about purchasing and using articles that are made by a cooperative system that we rarely stop to consider all of the implications, but move forward instinctively to more cooperation when new problems present themselves. Cooperation and social action 100 and more years ago developed machine production that largely overcame the hazard of want based on scarcity of goods. The same cooperation of individuals, men and money rarely lies back of the building and operating of railroads, telephones, automobiles. Men found their answer to the needs for of education by social and cooperative action in order to get schools, libraries, museums, fairs. The systems of life insurance, fire and accident insurance, which are commonplaces of today, are fundamentally extensions of the principle of cooperation and mutual and social action. Men pool so small contributions in an insurance fund and withdraw from that fund according to their special disaster and special needs. Not everyone is hit by the disaster, but all contribute. In a political democracy such as ours, functioning as it does within an economic society, where machinery and systems of exchange make possible plentiful goods and a stimulating material and intellectual civilization, there is bound to develop a great awareness of individual problems and hazards within the social structure. Cooperation and mutuality being well nigh compulsory in our ordinary economic life in order to get the goods we need, it becomes natural for us to use that same technique for handling these other individual problems and hazards. The social progress and the social consciousness of the last 20 years in American life is largely the result of this deduced program of action. Government in a democracy is an instrument of cooperation and mutual service and has been helpfully used by the American people in this way for generations. Now the time has come, it seems to me, to apply this technique to the more obvious and individual economic hazards that still exist within our social system. There are many hazards that the individual alone cannot provide against under the terms of modern life. Therefore, plans and provisions should be made by the community against these. And one of the challenges, of course, that grows out of our modern way of life is to affect the interplay of individual effort and social effort. But the plans for social security must be made effective in the beginning. The obvious and readily admitted economic problems of the individual life are involuntary unemployment, unprovided for old age, childhood without minimum financial safety, and dependency due to special physical handicaps, such as blindness, crippling, and the like. There are others, of course, but these stand out accusingly in our modern civilization and challenge us to make a social plan that will provide individuals with a life net in case they are caught within one of these hardships, which are all too common. No one of us knows on which one of us these hardships may fall, but certainly they will fall on some of us. Let us therefore use the old reliable means of cooperation and mutuality, in which we all make contribution of some sort, so that a systematic and orderly provision may be made as a matter of course for those of us who in the future suffer one or more of these afflictions. There has been a progressive feeling of public responsibility for these hazards, which passing through the purely philanthropic stage, and we've seen a great deal of it in the last 5 years, now manifests itself in a growing demand and understanding of the need for practical and systematic assistance on a general basis for all of these handicaps. The security of the wage earner has become a definite matter of national concern, partly because it is seen that the economic health of the country depends on the economic stability of the whole community and upon regular purchasing power of the low-income groups who are so numerous, who form the largest part of our population. The cost of insecurity in the loss of internal markets is a very large one. Idle labor with no pay envelopes to spend, old people without normal purchasing power do not encourage the increase in the production and activity of our industries. Experience in many countries has shown that it is possible through the development of social insurance methods to check much of this waste and somewhat to stabilize internal markets, even in a depression. The operation of the present Social Security Act and its development by experience will not only carry us a long way toward the goal of economic security for the individual, but also a long way toward the promotion and stabilization of mass purchasing power, without which the present mass production system cannot permanently be maintained. The terms of this Act provide the majority of our people with a substantial measure of security in infancy and childhood, in the economic crises of working life, and in old age. It will be one of the forces working against the recurrence of severe depression in the future, as the principle of sustained purchasing power in hard times makes itself felt through unemployment insurance, and as regularity of spending by older people when they have passed their working age becomes a factor in our industrial planning for steady markets. Certainly there is need of planning and of organized foresight to take care of these matters. The act which is just now going into effect, has in its outlines recognizes and deals with a wide variety of social distress and maladjustment which has long been present in American life, in times of plenty as well as in times of depression. The measure provides at present a modest degree of protection against the known hazards. It is reasonable, and if it errs, it is in the direction of safety, of taking on only known problems and of making the original provision well within the capacity of our present business structure and our present business outlook. The growth of this program upon the present principles will inevitably and naturally take place as a response to the experience that will only come out of fair and honest administration by conscientious officers. The Social Security Act provides, if I may take the time to outline what it is directly, provides federal grants in aid for old age pensions provided for in the state to those who are now both aged and indigent. The federal government will match state dollar for dollar up to $15 per month by the federal government and any amount more which the state may see fit to add in providing free pensions for all people who are without other means of support. The state must, however, comply with certain standards in order to get this federal grant in aid, certain standards in their old age pension administration and laws, including an age limit of 65, although 70 is the usual rule today, and a residence requirement of not more than 5 years out of the 9 years preceding application. 39 states already have old age pensions, but many of the state laws have to be revised in order to meet these standards. The same sort of assistance is given by federal grants in aid to the needy blind, and 28 states now make many of them inadequate provision for assistance to the needy blind. The bill also provides federal grants in aid for mothers' pensions where there is a dependent family without a breadwinner. 46 states have pension laws for mothers with dependent children, but the funds are so inadequate that only about 109,000 families in the United States are receiving regular mother's aid allowances under state laws, although there are three times that number of fatherless families now on the relief roll. The inadequacy of the state funds and the irregularity of their administration has been the cause of this anomaly. Under the present act, the states may secure federal aid of one-third of their total expenditure on fatherless families, up to $18 a month for one child and $12 for each additional child in a household, to enable mothers to take care of their own children at home. And this, of course, will be an extraordinary, a good expansion of a principle of taking care of dependent children in their own home. The Act also provides grants and aid for child and maternal health care. It provides grants and aid for neglected and handicapped children. It provides grants and aid by the federal government to the states for health protection. The federal appropriation will be allotted to the states for strengthening their present public health services or developing public health services where they have none. This, of course, in the direction of preventing illness. The state also provides two other forms of Social Security, which are in the insurance aspect rather than in the relief aspect. The Act provides for compulsory old age insurance under United States government supervision. The problem of the wage earner too old to be hired is growing yearly in size. Today, 6% of our population is 65 years of age and over, and by 1965, the percentage will be doubled. To prevent future old age dependency as far as possible, now is the time to set up a compulsory old age insurance program. Contributions to this are by employers and employees jointly.
beginning January 1, 1937, a tax of 1% is levied on each payroll and upon wages up to $3,000, increasing gradually as it reaches 3%. Benefits on a retirement at 65 are from $10 to $85 a month. Contributions under this title will prove no fearful burden on industry, and the alternatives may be very expensive. The alternatives may be a great extension of the system of free pensions, not only to the needy, but to all who want them. And we have seen enough in this country in the last year of movements of that sort to realize how overpoweringly expensive any such program would be. To give those people over 65 years of age $30 a month now, those who are living now, to give them $30 a month without regard to necessity would cost $2.5 billion annually out of the tax budget, a good round bill to underwrite. Old age insurance by contribution will build up on a sound actuarial principle, a system of annuities through which those who have contributed can withdraw in proportion to their contributions when they become 65 years of age. As you know, the Security Act also provides for unemployment insurance by federal-state cooperation. Unemployment varies somewhat by localities and by states, and for that reason it has been put upon a basis of cooperation between the federal and state governments. The Social Security Act has devised what seems like a truly American plan based upon our method of administration and of government. Nine states have already, and the District of Columbia have already accepted the term, and are building up the necessary cooperating legislation. The method, as many of you know, is the application of a uniform federal payroll tax, starting at 1% in 36 and rising to 3% in 38 on every employer of 8 or more persons throughout the country. If an employer contributes, however, to an approved state insurance system, the federal government credits him with such contributions up to 90% of the tax, reserving only 10% for administration. The method of benefits is left entirely to the state laws. The states will decide how much and how long benefits are to be paid. Administration is to be through public employment offices, also set up by a state-federal administrative agreement. No money can be spent, however, until the states pass laws which are approved by the Social Security Board and meet certain minimum standards. The principal arguments for planning for Social Security today seem to me to be these. First, it will promote economic stability for all of society. Second, it will reduce relief costs both regularly and in times of economic upheaval. Third, it will continue and build up our internal market even during a depression. And fourth, it will encourage employers to plan their industries. Economic upheaval. Third, it will continue and build up our internal markets even during a depression. And fourth, it will encourage employers to plan their industries with the thought of the stabilization of employment. And fifth, it is just and gives to wage earners on low incomes opportunity to share in the security and peace of mind that civilization under a machine system ought to bring to all.